talk of New York. Our next news at 4:30 with Lester Smith. No Blue Monday around here. No, no, no. Not with Bob and Ray.
Hi, okay, Roger. Roger. Thank you, sir. And hello again, everybody. We greet you here on the first Monday of the new spring, and you couldn't tell it was spring out today.
No, we're right back in the winter again, but can't be too much more left. We have one canceled train we might as well tell you about right off the bat. Long Island announces the 4:53 Babylon to Patchogue, which was due at 5:24, was canceled because of equipment trouble. Buses are handling the passengers, and the railroad expects no delays.
And now, could we have a theme for Widen Your Horizons?
Welcome again to our popular Bob and Ray public service feature, Widen Your Horizons, a portion of the show where we help you acquire new skills for leading a fuller, happier life. Today our subject is how to count your pocket change, and to deliver the lecture on that topic we have Mr. Quentin L. Farber of the Volunteers Council for Consumer Protection. Mr. Farber, you were telling us before you went on the air that Americans are cheated out of, I think you said, $3 billion a year simply because they don't know how to count change, and I find that figure astounding.
Well, of course, it's only an estimate, but we think it's fairly accurate based on the big shortage of pennies last year, which you may remember.
I do remember the penny shortage, but I didn't realize it was brought on because people don't know how to count their change.
Oh, yes, indeed. You see, the average consumer has never learned the value of the various coins in circulation. So he's quite happy when he gets a handful of pennies in change after making a purchase. And we believe that unscrupulous merchants caused the shortage by stocking up on billions of pennies to pass out to their customers.
Certainly a shabby practice at best, and I can appreciate why your group is trying to educate the public. So why don't you move right along to your informative lecture,
sir? Thank you. I'd like to do that. Now, first, it should be stated that consumers will have to learn to add before they can count their change quickly and easily.
Uh-oh.
But before getting to that, I always use visual aids to point out that coins have varying denominations printed right on them.
Well, of course, that means they're not all worth the same amount.
True, but it's more confusing than it seems because the small ones are sometimes worth more than the bigger ones. For example, let's take some of these coins I brought along for demonstration purposes.
Okay.
This brown one is the familiar penny, and it has the words 1 cent clearly printed on the back. But when we look at this smaller silver coin, which appears to be worth less, we see that it's labeled 1 dime.
Mm-hmm. So it's really worth 10 times as much as the penny, then.
Well, you're getting a little ahead of my lecture on that point, Mr. Elliott, so do you mind if I just handle this my own way?
No, not at all. I didn't realize I was going too fast.
Well, I'd like to display a 5-cent piece from my pocket here before I move on now. Let's see, I got another dime, and I got some more pennies. But I don't seem to have a 5-cent piece.
Well, just give me your dime, I'll give you 2 nickels.
Well, that's not going to help any. I need a 5-cent piece.
I know, you've already said that. I offered to give you 2 nickels for a dime.
Oh, I see what you mean. Now, a nickel's the same as a 5-cent piece.
Mm.
How many of them did you say you'd give me for a dime?
2.
Let me figure that out. Dime's worth 10 cents. So we divide that by 5. Oh, no, wait. You give me 2 of them, so we divide by 2.
Well, Mr. Farber, I hate to ask an embarrassing question, but how long have you been doing this type of work for the Consumers Council?
I've been with them for about 3 years now, but I've been working mostly on comparing different brands of vacuum cleaners.
See. Of course, so you don't need to know how to count your pocket change to do that, right?
No, but Mr. Abernathy went over this whole subject with me 2 or 3 times before I left the office, and I thought I had it down pat. For instance, if you buy an item for 89 cents and give me a dollar, I'm supposed to give you this dime and 1 penny back. But now you're trying to do something different.
Well, I was just trying to provide you with 2 nickels so you could go on with the lecture, but I have a hunch you couldn't have gone much further anyway.
No, I was starting to get pretty mixed up there. I guess maybe I'd better go back to the office and have Mr. Abernathy run through this thing for me again.
Yeah, I think you'd better do that, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Goodbye. Bye. You've been listening to...
Excuse me. Which of these coins should I give the bus driver to get back to the office now?
Well, I'll just give him a dollar. He'll probably give you some pennies and change.
Okay, thanks.
You've been listening to an informative lecture entitled How to Count Your Change. And be sure and join us again soon when we'll have another opportunity to learn a valuable new skill on our next session of Widen Your Horizons.
member FDIC.
Next, Mary Backstage, Noble Wife. The story of America's favorite family of the footlights and of their fight for security and happiness against the concrete heart of Broadway. Today, rehearsals for La Traviata are due to begin at La Scala Opera House in Milan. And with Mary still missing, Harry, Calvin, and Pop arrived only moments ago to be greeted by Greg Marlowe, who says...
Any sign of Mary?
Not a bit, Greg. We're terribly worried about her.
Well, I should imagine so. Till she gets here, though, I thought maybe we could go over a little bit of the story.
Yes, that would be...
I was explaining to you, La Traviata is based on the old Dumas play,
yes.
The Camellias. Or
I wonder if you can have those carpenters stop. I can't hear you very well.
Well, they have to continue building the sets.
Uh-huh.
Now, you see, in Act One, the overture and the orchestra will be right down there.
Right there, I see.
You
right.
See that pop?
Yes. Yeah, I see it.
And do you see it too?
Is that the prompter's box there in the middle?
Yeah, that's right.
Because he may have a lot to do with Mary and Harry and the opera.
Hey, that's very interesting. And then where would I make my entrance? Well, just one thing at a time.
Yes.
Now, you see, the overture begins with a tragic melody that's descriptive of Violetta's fatal illness. Now, of course, Mary will play Violetta. Hey, will you watch it, please, buddy?
We're trying to concentrate on the libretto over here.
I don't think they understand. They don't know English, you know.
I know they don't.
What's so funny? You almost scared me half to death. Now,
Go back again a little bit.
All right, I say the overture will begin with the tragic melody that is descriptive of Violetta's fatal illness.
This whole thing is rather a sad opera, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Oh, my, yes.
Oh, I'm learning more and more.
Well, everybody leaves the theater humming the songs, don't they? Not exactly.
Usually the case of happy songs.
Would you watch it, please?
Oh, I don't think we can rehearse here with all of this noise going on.
They just throw up their hands and give me the horse laugh. I'm trying to be serious. I'm trying to explain to these people about the opera.
They're just making sport of you guys. They're not paying any attention whatsoever.
I think they're taking advantage of the language barrier.
They're certainly,
you know,
having a good time as they put the scenery together.
They just, you know, shrug their shoulders and do this.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand.
Yeah. What the heck are they doing now?
Can't you do that?
I thought there was supposed to be a time for rehearsal for the stars and a time for the stagehands.
Now, the overture begins with the tragic melody that is descriptive, I know, of Violetta's fatal illness. You told us that three times.
It's a sad opera, in other words.
And later it's fully developed into the hauntingly beautiful introduction to the last act. Now, of course, if Mary doesn't show up by tomorrow, then, Pop, I'll have to ask you to take Violetta's part.
Well, you're not going to open until a week from Friday. She'll show up by that time.
But until she gets here, you'll play Violetta.
I'll just kind of stand in for Violetta, okay?
Now, after the overture, the curtain will rise.
And so Greg continues to fill in Harry, Calvin, and Pop on the details of La Traviata, due to open a week from Friday at La Scala. And you ought to be here tomorrow when we'll hear Calvin say,
"Oh, you mean to tell me Violetta dies in the end?"
That's tomorrow in the next exciting episode of Mary Backstage, Noble Wife. Word Carr speaking.
United States Mint, one of the nation's outstanding producers of fine new money, brings you another dramatic story from the files of the Emergency Ward.
Greetings and welcome. I'm Dr. Gerhard Snutten, handsome young physician who's not yet established a practice of his own. Instead, I work in the emergency ward of a big city hospital. And the emergency ward is a place where the drama of human misery unfolds night and day. Take the other evening, for example. I was utilizing a spare moment to do scientific research when my assistant, Nurse Rudehouse, turned to me and said,
"Why are you staring into that bowl of goldfish, Doctor?"
"I'm taking note of a fact that may have great medical significance, Nurse Rudehouse. These goldfish are actually swimming to the top of the bowl to eat."
Well, of course they do. How else would they get their food when it floats on the surface?
Well, that's completely beside the point. The importance of this discovery lies in the fact that people eat sitting down, while fish stretch out to their full length. Yet we get gastrointestinal illness and fish don't. There's a lesson in that for all of us.
Excuse me. Is this the emergency ward of a big city hospital?
Yes, and I'm Dr. Gerhard Snutten, handsome young physician who's not yet established a practice of his own. Now, before we move on to other social pleasantries, I wonder if you could identify that apple growing out of your nose. Is it a wine sap or a red delicious?
I don't know what kind it is, Doc. It's not growing out of my nose. You see, I was bobbing for apples at a party, and this one had an extra long stem that got jabbed all the way up my nostril and got stuck there.
Well, of course, I can't estimate your chances for survival until I have you on the operating table. Hopefully, I can avoid opening your skull, unless the foreign object has pierced your brain.
Oh, Doctor, you can't be seriously thinking of operating on this man just because he has an apple stem stuck up his nose.
Nurse Rudehouse, I've warned you before about discussing a patient's grave illness in his presence. It tends to frighten people.
Well, what you just said must have scared him out of his wits. I wouldn't even call his case a grave illness.
Well, frankly, I'm not interested in what you'd call it. A nursing school diploma hardly qualifies you to have an opinion about my diagnosis.
Why, excuse me, but if you people are planning to fight for a while, I think I'll get out to the cafeteria and get a sandwich. They didn't serve any food at the party before I had to leave.
Oh, very well. Just be careful when you slip the sandwich into your mouth. Bumping it against that apple can only make matters worse.
Okay, Doc, I'll take it slow.
Nurse Rudehouse, notify surgery that I'll have an emergency case coming down in a matter of moments. I already scrubbed up at home this morning, so we won't lose any time there.
Hey, Doc, guess what?
I don't need to guess. I already know the cafeteria is closed at this hour.
I could be. I didn't get there. I was just leaving this room, though, when your swinging door hit me in the back of the head and jarred the apple loose.
Well, to a medical man, that's not surprising in the least. Same principle as slapping a newborn baby on the back that started breathing. But as a layman, you wouldn't understand.
No, I don't understand, but I guess I don't need to now. Now that I get the apple out of my nose. What do I owe you for all your help, Doc?
Well, I hadn't actually done much work on your case yet. Of course, my years of experience were vital in formulating the proper diagnosis, so what would you say to a dollar?
Well, that sounds fair enough. Here you are, Doc. Goodbye.
Bye. Well, Nurse Rudehouse, medical science has done it again. A man hovering between life and death has been brought back to the point where his vital signs are again normal. So you may simply write the entry in your casebook, patient released, cured.
And so the tireless dedication of those who work in a big city hospital has again reclaimed a hopeless victim. And join us again soon when the United States Mint, producer of money, will present more tense drama from the files of The Emergency Ward.
Remember the ex-serviceman's banter? Spare a copper.
Spare a copper? Why, I want all the money I've got. Go on, get away, get away. Soft.
What a mean man.
You know who that is? Millionaire. You remember Finicky Luca?
Finicky Luca, yes.
That's his brother, Filthy Luca. Doesn't know how to enjoy his money.
No? Hey, mister, with £1 million and a kind of nervous indigestion. Rich mister, with everything in life, I'd just like to ask you one question.
Why you silly so and so? With all your dough, are you having any fun? What are you getting out of living? What good is what you got if you're not having any fun? Are you having any laughs? Are you getting any loving? If other people do, so can you have a little fun. After the honey's in the comb, little bees go out and play. Even the old gray mare down home has got to have hay. Are you having any fun? You ain't gonna live forever. Before you're old and gray, still okay. Have a little fun, son. Have a little fun. Thank you. and slave and sail. Life is full of its and but you know the squirrels save and save. And what have they got? Nuts are you having any fun? You ain't gonna live forever before you're old and gray. Still okay, have a little fun, fun. Have a little fun.
Flanagan and Allen, and we're back to the old ones, right?
Yeah, it's one from the old Bob and Ray Hit Parade. It's 12 minutes now before 5, and we have Squad Car coming along presently.
Okay, lady, where's the fire?
It's at home, officer. I have spaghetti cooking, and I'm out of Montini tomatoes.
You mean those Montini peeled pear-shaped tomatoes?
Right.
With basil leaf flavor?
Mm, yes.
You know, basil flavor, the real Italian kind?
That's the can I'm after.
Well, that's not the can you almost got, lady, but follow me and I'll save your day.
He really means he'll save my spaghetti sauce.
When you need a great-tasting Italian sauce for spaghetti, ravioli, lasagna, or your other special Italian dish, always begin with Montini tomatoes. Montini are those special Italian-style plum-peeled tomatoes packed with fresh basil leaf. Look for the red, green, and blue Montini can wherever you shop, and you'll like the price, too.
That wasn't the squad car I was thinking about. I was thinking of Squad Car 119. We'll have that in a little while. Right now, though, let's go aloft to Helicopter 710, see how the traffic is moving along this Monday afternoon with Chief Pilot Fred Feldman.
And moving along it is, ladies and gentlemen. In Manhattan, we really could not be off to a much better start going up the West Side Highway or the FDR-Harlem River Drive combination. And in the lower Bronx, we're also off to a relatively good start. The Bruckner Expressway is fine. The Major Deegan is fine. But on the Cross Bronx, you will find the traffic very slow coming out of Manhattan and starting eastbound on that Cross Bronx till you get past the on and off traffic in the area of Grand Concourse. All lanes are open a minute ago. George Washington Bridge, upper deck good in both directions. On the lower deck, there's some minor delays into New York City. And on the Jersey side, no problems to or from the Fort Lee area. We'll be back with more in just a little bit, gentlemen.
And let's see, here on the ground, the Long Island Railroad canceled the 453 from Babylon to Patchogue because of equipment trouble. The buses will handle the passengers, and they don't expect any delays on that. And the Penn Central's 320 from Grand Central, due in at 427, is running well. It's just about getting in now because of equipment trouble. Now, the makers of Einbinder Flypaper, a name you've gradually grown to trust over the course of three generations, invite you to ride with the men of Squad Car 119.
My name's Sam Finch. Me and my partner, Ralph R. Kruger Jr., are the unsung heroes of the police force. We ride a prowl car at night. Sometimes the streets are wet and pretty slippery. Other times they're dry and not slippery at all. Either way, we're always on the lookout for trouble. The other evening, we'd just gotten into the squad car to begin our shift when my partner, Ralph R. Kruger, Jr., turned to me and said,
"Say, how do they figure this amount they take out of our paychecks for the police charity fund, Sam?"
It's 1% of the gross, Ralph R., Jr.
"Well, I know that, Sam, but how do they figure it? Whenever I take a number and multiply or divide it by one, I always get the same number I started with."
"Yeah, I guess it would work out that way. But to figure 1%, I think you just move the decimal point over two places."
"Sure seems like a lot of money when you figure it that way, Sam. I'd have to give the police charity fund $21,000 a week, and I can't afford it."
"Well, maybe you're moving the decimal point over two places the wrong direction, Ralph R., Jr. Try moving it two places the other way."
"Sure seems like a lot of money when you figure it that way, Sam. $2.10 a week. I really can't afford it."
"Yeah, it does seem like a unusual amount."
"Calling Car 119, Car 119. Investigate reports of a nude man in a tree in the 800 block of East Roxbury. That's a nude man in a tree at 800 East Roxbury."
"800 East Roxbury, huh?"
"That's us, Sam. Let's roll."
"No, I'm not sure whether we should, Ralph R. Jr. I think the 800 block of Roxbury is across the line in Beverly Hills. L.A. police aren't supposed to make arrests in Beverly Hills."
"Yeah, they could really throw the book at us for that, Sam."
"Yeah.
We're never supposed to go outside L.A. at all. Are you sure 800 Roxbury is in Beverly Hills?"
"Just one side of the street, I think. But I'd sure feel silly if we were on the Beverly Hills side and the police there arrested us for trying to arrest a citizen."
"Yeah, and they could really throw the book at us, too, Sam."
"Yeah.
We don't even have a permit to carry a gun in Beverly Hills."
"I know. They could really throw the book at us on that one."
"Yeah, and besides that, our car insurance is only good in L.A. we had an accident in Beverly Hills, they could really throw the book at us.
Yeah, any accident we had outside the L.A. limits, they could really throw the book at us.
Yeah, but it's especially tough in Beverly Hills, Sam. If you step out of line there, they really throw the book at you.
Yeah, that's right. They really would in a case like this, too.
Car 119, disregard that call to investigate reports of a nude man in a tree in the 800 block of East Roxbury. The case has been handled by the men of Squad Car 236. The suspect has been apprehended, booked, and brought to trial. In 1 minute, the results of that trial.
And while we wait to hear the outcome of today's exciting case, here's a message for all patriotic Americans from the makers of Einbinder Fly Paper. Friends, are you willing to let your country's economy go down the drain just because cheap fly paper made in Hong Kong or Taiwan costs a few pennies less than Einbinder? No, of course you're not. Loyal Americans have always banded together in the face of threats from abroad, and we know you can be counted on again. So just step up to your favorite store counter and do your duty for your country today. Ask for genuine Einbinder fly paper, the domestic brand you've gradually grown to trust over the course of three generations.
That suspect reported to be nude in a tree at 800 East Roxbury proved beyond all doubt that 800 East Roxbury is within the city limits of Beverly Hills. Being nude in a tree in Beverly Hills is not against the law.
And so justice once again prevails, thanks to the unsung heroes of the police force, the men who ride the squad cars at night.
This is John Scott. Next news as it happens, next scheduled news at 5:30 over WOR Radio 710, The Talk of New York. And now more Bob and more Ray and more Radio New York over WOR New York.
And now it's time for another story of drama and tense emotion. A tale well designed to keep you in anxiety. And here with us again to set the stage for our latest thriller is the noted author and world traveler, Commander Neville Putney. Well, Commander, I feel sure that you've reached into your amazing file and brought forth another tale, well designed to keep us in anxiety.
Yes, indeed, I jolly well have, young man. This fascinating yarn concerns two of your Yankee doughboys who are seeing frontline action during World War II. Naturally, they'd had a few close calls chasing the Boche all across Europe. But by the spring of 45, the enemy's resistance was weakening. And with hopes for victory in the air, our heroes had no cause to believe that they would soon be brought face to face with anxiety. The central figures in our epic wartime drama were named Corporal Bergen Majors and Private Benson Sergeant. It was the duty of Corporal Majors and Private Sergeant to scout ahead for signs of enemy activity. They had just completed such a mission and were headed back to rejoin their outfit, when Colonel Majors turned to his colleague and spoke with a quaver in his voice.
Does it seem to you that I'm speaking with a quaver in my voice, Private?
No, I hadn't noticed it. Of course, we get such poor radio reception over here that I guess I've become used to hearing voices that all have quavers in them. However, I don't suppose a weak radio signal could be the cause of your quaver, since you're standing right beside me in person.
That's very true, Private. In fact, I'd attribute my quaver solely to the fact that I've spotted enemy troops in that foxhole just ahead of us. Now, I don't know how we get our directions mixed up like this, but we're obviously behind the German lines.
Oh, dear. That is rotten luck. And I hear the Germans aren't treating their war prisoners too well these days, either. They seem to have gotten peeved because they're losing the war, and they're taking it out on us as if it were our fault or something.
Yes, I'm afraid we're in for a rather rough time of it, Private Sergeant. I understand the enemy troops have gotten word from their high command to shoot all Americans on sight. And, of course, we're bound to be sighted almost any moment now, since we have nowhere to hide.
True, true. And it wouldn't do us any good to deny that we're Americans. After all, we're wearing American uniforms and conversing in English.
Quite right. So I'm afraid that the German order to shoot all Americans on sight hasn't left a single loophole for us to squirm through.
Well, then, I guess this is goodbye, Corporal Majors. I'm sorry I won't live long enough to see you make sergeant.
Well, thank you, Private Sergeant. I'm equally sorry I won't live to see you make corporal, but it's much too late to think of that now. Those Germans in their stormtrooper helmets are starting to turn this way, and they certainly can't avoid spotting us. So this is it, Private. Farewell.
There. How about
How's that for a bit of a sticky wicket, young man?
Oh, boy. Sure had me in the grip of anxiety there, Grandpa. How did it all come out? Did the Germans spot Private Sergeant and Corporal Majors as they both expected?
No. As chance would have it, the two men were trapped behind their own lines, not the enemy's. So, of course, the chaps they saw in the foxhole ahead were really American soldiers wearing German helmets.
Wait a minute, Commander, that's ridiculous. Why would American soldiers be wearing German helmets on the battlefield during World War II?
As matters developed, it wasn't during World War II. It was about 20 minutes after the war ended. Of course, that's why the Americans were celebrating by wearing the German helmets they'd captured as trophies of war. Only our two heroes didn't know that the fighting had ended, so you can see it was all quite logical.
Well, frankly, I don't see anything logical about it. And to me, the most illogical part is why you'd drag out a dumb story like that and try to palm it off on our listeners as a tale of anxiety.
Now, that'll be quite enough of your uninformed criticism of the stories I bring forth from my amazing file. Now, I'll thank you to get on with the closing announcement before I have you cashiered for insubordination.
Well, after what you just put us all through, I'm sure there's not a jury in the world that would convict me. But maybe reading this announcement will get rid of you, so I'll give it a whirl. Friends, be sure to join us again next time when Commander Putney will again reach into his amazing file and bring forth a tale well designed to keep you in anxiety.
And now, the American Federation of Sheep Herders, representing 14,000 lonely people just like yourself, brings you another episode of The Gathering Dusk. The heartwarming story of a girl who's learned to live with misfortune because she could never learn how to do anything else. As we look in on the Bessinger household today, Edna is making a geometric design with thumbtacks on the downstairs bulletin board. It's early evening, and Mr. Muzzpaw, the village guru and interpreter of the occult, is just arriving.
Oh, it's you, village guru, interpreter of the occult, Muzzpaw. I would have met you at the door, but I was afraid I might miss you in case you came floating in through the transom.
No, I don't display supernatural powers myself, Miss Bessinger. I merely serve as a link between those who are still here and those who have gone on before.
Well, my father was in a similar line of work. When he was still here, he arranged to be the link for a mob in Detroit that wanted the whole Watanabe gang to go on before.
Well, I wouldn't say that's similar to what I do at all, ma'am. Your father was hitman for the syndicate. I just charge law-abiding citizens $5 apiece to look into the world beyond.
Well, I really think you'd find that pushing them into the world beyond is a more profitable end of the business. Here, you're working for $5 a throw, and Daddy never got less than $2,000 for a job. That was in the depth of the Depression, too.
Well, I suppose you could live rather well on that amount of income in those days.
No, not really. Daddy's life insurance premiums were terribly high. I think he paid about $20,000 a year for a $500 policy. The insurance company figured that a person in his line of work had a life expectancy of 16 days.
I see. Well,
they also had a special waiver in there that made Daddy's policy void in case he was killed by my brother Waldo. Waldo was a homicidal maniac, and I guess you're considered a bad insurance risk if you have one of those in the family.
Well, I really don't know anything about issuing insurance policies, Miss Bessinger. But I just hope you didn't call me over here to try to make contact with your father or your brother. I'm sure they both wound up in a place where I wouldn't be able to reach them.
No, I'd never ask you to get involved in a family matter like that, village guru and interpreter of the occult, Muzzpaw. What I'm really more interested in is having you do right now for me is to get Kurt Gowdy off my back.
You mean Kurt Gowdy, the sportscaster?
Yes, I'd know his voice anywhere, especially when he gets into one of those long stories about a third baseman who fell into a concrete mixer when he was a child, but then overcame the handicap to play in the major leagues. Kurt was telling me all about that from somewhere in the great beyond just before you came in.
Oh, Miss Bessinger, Kurt Gowdy couldn't be speaking to you from the great beyond. He's very much alive.
Well, I'm sure it was his voice, and for a minute there I thought I heard the voice of Tony Kubek, too. Right now, all I'm receiving from the great beyond is some man's voice trying to sell me radial tires. I think Kurt Gowdy said it's between innings over there.
Miss Bessinger, Kurt Gowdy is not in the great beyond, and neither are those other people you're talking about. But I think I see what your trouble is now, that you've turned your head this way. You've got a transistor radio in your apron pocket. And then there's a cord running up from it to a plastic plug in your ear.
Glory be. I'll just bet that could explain the whole mysterious situation, village guru and interpreter of the occult Mazpah. I remember now that I put the earpiece in there this morning so I could hear the latest rhythm and blues selections while I was mowing the front lawn. But as soon as it got dark, I started getting messages from Kurt Gowdy, and he's been going on ever since. My stars. It's a relief to know that Kurt's not trying to bother me from some other world. I suddenly feel as if I'm no longer standing in the gathering dusk.
Can it be that Edna will now step through the doorway to real happiness, having at last found a way to make Kurt Gowdy leave her alone? Or will it only lead to further heartbreak when she realizes that nobody at all is talking to her now that the radio is shut off? Be sure to join us for the next episode when Edna may be forced to resume her conversation with the goldfish in the gathering dusk.
From the Hotel Sheets in downtown Pleasantville, the Michigan Broadcasting Company presents the music of Pete DeAngelis and his loyal Pleasantvillians. Here in the beautiful gold, yellow, copper, steel, iron ballroom of the Hotel Sheets in downtown Plunkettville, overlooking the uptown section of downtown Parkstown. Stay with us, won't you, and enjoy the sweetest music this side of the Monongahela River. 1 mile high, 2.5 blocks from the center of old New Orleans. Ah, there's gaiety, merriment, and dancing in the Hotel Sheets nightly. Now, to get things underway, Pete and his loyal banditos play a medley of old standard favorites, commencing with Your Red Scarf Matches Your Eyes, Close Cover Before Striking, Your Father Had the Shipfitter Blues, and Loving You Has Made Me Bananas.
Isn't that exciting?
Picture and lovely lyric portrayed vocally by Dickie Ryan.
Scarf matches your eye. You closed your cover before striking. Father had the shipfitter blues. Loving you has made me bananas. Your red scarf matches your eye. You closed your cover before striking. Father had the shipfitter blues. Loving you has made me bananas. Oh, you burnt your finger that evening while my back was turned. I asked the waiter for I dined, but I dined all alone.
Don't break up now.
Oh, you burnt your finger that evening while my back was turned. I asked the waiter for I dined, but I dined all alone. Oh, your red scarf matches your eyes. You closed your cover before striking. Father had a has made me bananas.
Oh, I love it!
First, we have to check on the traffic. And here in Helicopter 710, Fred Feldman. And on the subways, there are 10-minute delays on the northbound K, F, B, and D trains because of a stalled subway at 34th Street here in Manhattan.
And on the from the WOR newsroom, the headline of the hour, New York City says it will pull out of Social Security system. Roger Skivenis will have details at 6 o'clock. And in just a minute, we'll have the Word Wizard.
Everyone knows that MailGram has impact. But what can you do with MailGram's impact? You can place an order.
Holidays coming, and I was out of turkeys. No turkeys, no holidays. So I sent MailGrams to every wholesaler, and by the...
Or cancel an order.
Book the barnyard, boys. Then I find out it's two chickens and a trained goat. So I sent the agent a MailGram, let him have...
Or get the facts straight.
We needed 5 carloads by the 20th, not 20 carloads by the 5th. So quick, I called Western Union, I sent a MailGram, and I had...
Every day, thousands of people discover the impact of Western Union's Mailgram because there are thousands of ways to use it. Mailgram messages are easy to send. Just call Western Union's toll-free number. Within seconds, your message is flashed electronically to a post office near your addressee for delivery in writing with the next business day's mail. We can also show you how to send mailgrams by computer to hundreds or thousands of people for less than a dollar each. Western Union's Mailgram. Impact of a telegram at a fraction of the cost.
Time for another informative session with Dr. Elmer Stapley, the word wizard. Sit down, Doctor. Good to see you again. Dr. Stapley is one of the nation's leading authorities on the meaning and derivation of English words, and he's here to answer questions that you listeners sent in about our language and its correct use. You all ready to plunge into the mailbag and hit it, Doctor?
Hit what?
I mean, you ready to get started?
Well, Mr. Elliott, you just provided a grave exemplification of how people fail to transmigrate their ideas through bad grammar. When you asked me to hit it, you should have realization that hit is a transitive verb, and that makes the word it the premonition. However, it's also a preposterous noun, so it has to make referendum back to its ancestor. Only yours didn't. Do I make myself transatlantic?
Not quite, but let's replicate that opening. We'll plunge into the mailbag and hit it. This question comes from a lady in Oregon who says, my brother's wife claims that aspirin is one of those words that we don't add an S onto when we change it to the plural form. Why are there words of that type that stay the same when we're speaking of more than one of them?
Well, if the plural of aspirin changed into something else, then you'd be getting a different drug if you took two.
No, the woman isn't talking about a chemical change, Doctor. She's just asking why the singular and plural forms of aspirin are both the same. You know, it's like lettuce.
Well, if the woman is asking why aspirin is like lettuce, that's a different question whatsoever. The answer is that aspirin tends to turn green after it's been sitting on the shelf too long.
No, I don't think that'd be the right answer, even the right question. You want to try again?
No, once I've made a decision, I'm completely stagnant.
Okay, let's go to another letter then. Here's a man in Long Island who writes, years ago, my mother used to yell at me and say, Wilbur, stop doing that, or you'll break your neck. Now that I'm an adult, I realize that I've never heard of a person breaking his neck. Do you have any idea what my mother meant?
What's the name of the person who wrote that?
Signature is Charles W. Fossey.
I wonder why his mother called him Wilbur.
Well, his middle initial is W, because it could stand for Wilbur, huh?
Yeah, but it's terrible to call a kid by his middle name, unless it's better than his first name. And Wilbur isn't better than anything.
Okay, something peculiar about the whole situation. We don't like crank letters. Certainly don't answer them on the air, so I'm going to move right along to a letter from another woman. Writes, I get mixed up on using the words don't and doesn't. It's especially embarrassing when I'm turning down a party invitation. Sometimes I tell the hostess I don't want to come. Other times I say my husband doesn't want to come. But now my husband and I have been invited to a party that neither of us wants to attend. Which word should I use in explaining that?
Who's throwing the party?
I don't know. What difference does that make?
Well, quite a bit. It must be a terrible party since nobody wants to go, and I might get an invitation from the same dull people.
I don't think that's very dull. I see this letter comes from Montana, so maybe you should stick with the question. Should you use don't or doesn't when you're turning down an invitation to two people?
Well, in this case, I think the woman would be quite proper in saying, better we should both drop dead than have to come to your party.
Sounds grammatical. Socially correct, too, I guess. So I'm sure you've solved the lady's problem. Along with those of our other listeners, and I want to thank you for stopping by and sharing your wisdom with us.
Not at all. I was stupefied to come.
I thought you acted that way. Listen again soon when we'll have another informative session with Dr. Elmer Stapley, the word wizard.
It's a great...
As we once again return things to Bob and Ray.
Welcome to This Place for Heroes, dramatized events in the lives of ordinary citizens who never gave in, but waged a fight against unfairness, duplicity, and corruption. Today's dramatization concerns fearless small-town newspaper editor Fred John Wassell, who we'll meet after our story.
Alice, how's this for an editorial? It's time Turnberg stood up to them. 3 years ago, Turnberg was a good town. Then they came, a trickle of evil men at first. We didn't know then what they were up to, but we soon found out.
Oh, Fred, those men will come around again if you print that.
Turnberg, with a population of 1,210 people, had three jukeboxes in it 4 years ago. Now we've got 1,700 jukeboxes in Turnberg, more than one to a person. Now,
I'll see who it is, Fred.
No, better let me get that, Alice. And who is it?
You better open up, Warflow. It's me, Fist Faraday.
Alice, go home. You'll be safe there. Go through the back way.
Well, what about you, Fred?
No, do as I say, Alice. I think I'd like to go home, too. I'm no glory seeker. Just doing a nasty job, a job that has to be done. Now, please go.
All right, Fred.
I'll see you later.
Open up in there, Wassel, or I'll tear this joint apart.
The door is open, Faraday. Come on in.
Hello, small man. I understand you're writing another thing about me today.
Faraday, I'm going to tell you something. Your kind stinks. You know what you are? You're some kind of maniac from the Stone Age. You're from another world. You decided to make the trip here by sewer. And now you've arrived, covered with the stench of corruption. Faraday, your world is fast disappearing. Your world of muscle weakens more each day, and I can help the atrophy along with words. That's right, Faraday. Let your epitaph read. He was stricken by a typewriter.
And that was the courageous stand taken by editor Fred John Wassel. And now I'm sure you all want to meet the real Mr. Wassel. Mr. Wassel, I'd like you to say hello to the many fans you've made with your magnificent display of nerve.
Hello. I'm glad to be here.
I understand the wire was removed from your jaw yesterday, Mr. Wassel.
Yes, that's right. And I'm glad it was, too. Alice is teaching me to walk again, and now I can tell her to stop when I get tired.
But all this that's happened to you, Mr. Wassel, it really isn't important. The important thing is what the jukebox situation is like in Turnberg these days. That's what we'd like to hear about.
Well, I understand they put 7 jukeboxes in my newspaper office. I really don't see how I'll get around the office with all that crowding.
And your wife Alice tells me that you have to put in your own money, and whatever is in the machine has to be turned over to Faraday.
That's the understanding, yes.
Fred John Wassel, there isn't much I can say. You've said it all for us in words and in deed. You're a hero, and this is the place for heroes, here on This Place for Heroes.
Okay.
Now, we've had our ushers going through the studio audience looking for people with unusual occupations, and the result is this specimen seated with us right now, Mr. Leopold Nodel, or Nodel. I didn't get the pronunciation, sir.
Nodel.
Nodel, of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The questionnaire that you filled out, Mr. Nodel, said you're a professional racket maker. I guess it takes a good many years to master the technique of turning out championship tennis equipment, huh?
Well, yes, I imagine it does. Of course, that's just an off-the-cuff opinion. I've never really thought about it much because I have no intention of switching over from the type of rackets I make to tennis rackets.
Oh, well, then I've misunderstood what you do for a living, I guess.
Yes, I'd say that apparently you've misunderstood the whole thing pretty well.
Actually, you're an underworld figure who creates new rackets for the mob?
No, but I admire your great versatility in being wrong. No, you see, what I really do is I go around in the middle of the night making a racket on behalf of the Slumbermore Sleeping Pill Company.
Are you trying to tell me that your job is to wake people up deliberately so they'll have to take sleeping pills?
That's it. That's what I've been trying to tell you ever since you began by changing the subject.
Oh.
But the way your mind wanders, I'm right on the verge of giving up.
Oh, no. My mind doesn't wander as much as you might think, Mr. Nodel. Just that when you said you were a professional racket maker, it seemed inconceivable that making the type of racket you meant could be an occupation.
Well, I don't know what's so inconceivable about it. You see, there's only a limited number of people who can't sleep at night when things are quiet, and the pill companies already have that market pretty well saturated.
Uh-huh.
So, of course, the growth of the industry depends upon keeping the ones awake who'd sleep us right into bankruptcy if we left them alone.
Well, that makes a little bit of sense, I guess, in theory. How can you possibly create enough of a disturbance all by yourself to have much effect on the sale of sleeping pills?
Well, in answer to your question, it's impossible to answer because I don't work all by myself. The general public doesn't know it, but Slumbermore has the most employees of any company in the world. We have about 40 chemists at the home office making the pills, and about 300,000 field workers making the racket.
300,000 of you roaming around all night doing this awful thing?
Well, on any given night, the total is probably closer to a quarter of a million. We have more employees on sick leave than the average industry because we all work in the damp night air. But with the help of our stray cat training program, we still manage to keep about half the country awake.
You've got stray cats making racket for you, too?
Every district manager is responsible for following up on newspaper ads that offer free kittens to a good home. But, of course, we turn them loose as soon as they can be big enough to yowl and knock the lids off garbage cans and, you know, do annoying stuff like that.
Well, frankly, Mr. Nodal, I don't think I've ever heard of a business operation quite so unethical, and I certainly hope the Pure Food and Drug people crack down on you, but good.
Well, I hate to tell you, but I don't think there's much that can be done about us. Lumbermore is just cheap, harmless junk, and the only reason we imply that you need a prescription to get it is for people who call up their doctors. And then the doctors will have to take it to get them back to sleep, too.
Well, you got the whole thing worked out, haven't you?
All right. I could tell you about plans we've got that make your hair stand on end, but after working all night, I got to hurry home to bed so I can doze off and catch a few winks before the people who stay up all day start making a lot of racket.
I understand.
Goodbye.
Thank you for your visit anyway. Goodbye, sir.
And back now to Bob and Ray.
Okay, Stan, thank you. Good night, and we'll see you tomorrow. And that does it for Bob and Ray for today.
Got another week underway, but don't forget the WOR Radio Mystery Theater. Tonight it's called Stampede. It stars Fred Gwynne and Christopher Tabori, and it follows the Fulton Lewis News commentary.
And we'll see you tomorrow at 4:15. Until then, this is Ray Goulding reminding you to write if you get work.
Bob Elliott reminding you to hang by your thumbs.
And this is WOR New York, an RKO general station.